yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. They brought death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown, boys. Death to our hometown.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, as promised last week, we're going to go off in a little different direction here and talk about central banks. You know, the Federal Reserve Bank in the U.S., Bank of England, European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, People's Bank of China. These are the major central banks of the world here that determine pretty much the direction and policy of the world economy. Why are we looking at central banks? Why is this important? Well, it's important because central bank policy, sometimes called monetary policy, since 2008 has become virtually everywhere the driver of all economic policy and programs. You know, it used to be that fiscal policy played a role, fiscal policy meaning government spending and taxes, and it still does, although the emphasis is more on taxes, particularly tax cuts for businesses and investors, and spending cuts for the rest to make up for the tax cuts for businesses and investors. That used to be dominant. Fiscal policy is really how we got out of the Depression of the 1930s and how we managed to finance a global World War II. And it even played a major role in the post-World War period for a couple decades. But ever since the 1970s, there's been a definite shift towards turning over the helm to monetary policy, relying more on monetary policy. And this is especially in the 21st century. And, of course, it's the central banks who determine monetary policy. Well, what is monetary policy? Well, it's usually defined as something to do with controlling the money supply, the supply of money in the economy, increasing it or decreasing it, and its effect on interest rates. And interest rates either stimulating consumption when they for big ticket items like houses and cars, you know, when rates are lowered, or stimulating business investment when businesses borrow from banks at a cheaper interest rate and don't borrow when interest rates rise. Well, that's the way textbooks tend to describe monetary policy, but we're going to give you a different explanation and description of monetary policy here, because that's what maybe mainstream economics looks at it, but as is the case with much of mainstream economics, they look at surface issues and surface indicators and don't understand what's fundamentally going on. In fact, most of mainstream economics is designed to obfuscate that way and prevent really understanding what's going on. Okay, so monetary policy and central banks determine monetary policy. In the modern 21st century capitalist global economy, they determine or at least influence the money supply. You know, it's a little bit of a misunderstanding when people say, well, central banks control the money supply or determine the money supply. They influence it, but it's essentially the private banking system itself that makes the final decision, determination of whether to increase or decrease the supply of money, and therefore interest rates. We'll get back to that, okay? But you know, let's just start with this obvious point that it's the central banks and monetary policy that are driving policy since the crash of 2008 and 2009. They've been put in the catbird seat, central banks and monetary policy, and fiscal policy has been put in the corner, except, of course, for ever more tax cuts for corporations and investors. Government spending has been de-emphasized. It's sometimes called austerity. You've heard that term, austerity policy. Yeah, austerity means let's cut government spending for social programs and all the other social departments. Let's privatize whatever government programs or industries or production that might occur, turn it over to the private system. That's all part of austerity policy. There's other elements to austerity as well, but those are the main purposes of austerity: cut social spending, and boost privatization, and some other programs as well. But that austerity, that fiscal policy, has been put in the back seat, and monetary policy, which is the function of the central banks, has been put in the driver's seat here. And now monetary policy does not re-stimulate the economy the way aggressive fiscal spending might. It's a slow growth. It's a slow recovery approach. It's an approach in which the central bank's strategy is to provide free money to banks and other financial institutions, because now we have a banking system that's not purely commercial banks anymore. We have this phenomenon of shadow banks and blended shadow commercial banks, and even non-financial companies taking on financial banking-like activities. So it's a big blend, but what we have is this thing called shadow banking, and it's as big and perhaps globally even bigger now than a regular commercial banking. And economies don't rely simply on bank loans anymore, commercial and industrial loans. There are all these what's called capital markets where money is raised, stock equity issues and bond issues, which is a big favorite, corporate bonds, commercial paper, and all these other forms of securities where money is raised. It's even raised on the internet, crowdfunding, peer-to-peer funding, and so forth. So it's a very complex financial system. It's not just your traditional banks loaning money, right? Monetary policy in the 21st century is a policy where the central banks attempt to provide free money to the private banking/financial system. And the characteristic, defining characteristic is providing more and more free money, even far more than the banks can use to provide loans to real businesses, non-financial businesses, to generate real investment, real jobs, real things, real income, real consumption, real GDP. Okay? That's the defining characteristic. And it is the central banks that are the primary originating cause of global debt. Okay, what do we mean by that? Debt, means you are borrowing money from something in order to invest in something else. And to do that, however, you need liquidity. In other words, it's not just debt that's the key indicator of the change in the 21st century global capitalist economy. And, of course, debt has ever accelerated. And by debt, you have to distinguish between private corporate debt, financial debt, non-financial business debt, and household debt and government debt. You see, the big run-up in the crash of 2008 was private debt, business debt, financial debt. And it still is the big lion's share of total global debt. And it is the share that's growing rapidly once again, not only in the U.S., U.K., Europe, Japan, but in emerging markets in China and so forth. It's running away, global debt. But What causes that global debt acceleration is the real question. Well, you can't have debt without money, liquidity, to borrow, right? Without credit. Credit has to be extended to create the debt. Well, credit in what form? Well, money form. Well, where does the money come from? Ultimately, it comes from central banks. And it's been coming in waves and gushes since the 1970s. We'll get back to that when we talk about the history a little bit of central banks and their role, and specifically their role in generating runaway liquidity that has led to excess debt. And then, of course, we know what debt does when it reaches a limit that is unsustainable. Okay. So, what we're looking at is central bank being and central bank monetary policy being the centerpiece of post-2008 policy. And monetary policy is designed not to get a rapid recovery of the real economy. It's designed to, first and foremost, subsidize the banking system and the financial system by providing free money, essentially, to that banking and financial system. And the idea then is that with all this excess liquidity, private banks will then loan the money to non-financial businesses who will then invest invest. The banks will invest it themselves in non-financial businesses and will get real investment recovering. Well, you know, that's not how it's working. No, massive injections of liquidity by central banks have been the case ever since 2008, and the theory isn't working because the money is not flowing into real investment, you know, and expanding businesses and plants and factories and hiring and so forth. It's not flowing there. The money, the massive money, is flowing into financial markets, both in the U.S. and abroad. Some of it's going abroad to finance real investment, you know, in emerging markets and so forth. Some of it's being taken abroad in foreign direct investment by U.S. businesses to do that. But a lot of it is going abroad to invest in financial markets, as well as investing in financial markets here in the U.S. In other words, most of the money is bleeding out, leaking out into sources that don't generate real recovery. Because real recovery is measured, you know, by investment and consumption and so forth, and you've got to make things and increase production for that to happen. But if the money is being redirected, diverted into financial markets, then you're not going to get the real investment. And, of course, we look at the indicators in real asset investment, you know, what they call net capital formation, has stalled pretty much. It's been declining steadily, especially since 2008 in the U.S. and globally. And that produces a collapse of productivity, which has happened as well. Productivity has come to a halt here in the U.S. pretty much. And if there's no productivity, business costs rise and they don't give wage increases. And in fact, they cut wages and they find all kinds of ways to cut wages. Favorite being hire part-time temp workers, don't pay them any benefits, and keep turning them over, and that reduces the wage. Lots of reasons why we have wage compression in the U.S. We'll talk about that at some point. The general point here is that you central banks, since 2008, monetary policy in the lead, monetary policy designed to provide free money to banks and shadow banks, and that free money goes into financial speculation and financial asset markets. And the proof is, look at what's happened with stocks, equity prices here. They're still rising, separated from any fundamentals here. It's all the free money that just keeps flowing in from the central bank. you know, the excuse is, oh, well, the central bank has to put money into the economy to bail out the banks, like in 2008-09, which it did. To the tune, by the way, of tens of trillions of dollars, the U.S. and in the U.S. alone, well over 10, maybe 15 trillion dollars, through various ways, bumped into the banking system. The banks were bailed out quickly. You know, they were bailed out. You know, by 2010. Bailed out meaning no longer insolvent and having all the liquidity they need and just sitting on the liquidity. But they were bailed out, and then the question is, of course, well, why, if they were bailed out in 2010 by the various central bank tools designed to reduce interest rates to virtually zero, in other words, free money, and all the special auctions and the quantitative easing by the central banks, which pumped even more money directly into the economy, not just low rates, why, if all the banks were bailed out in 2010, why has it continued for another 6 to 7 years after 2010? You know, this is the seventh year we're in of virtually zero rates. The Fed has raised rates a little bit, but, you know, it's not going to raise them much more. We may get one more rate increase here in June, but after that, I predict that, you know, it's going to be pretty much flattening out. And, of course, in other countries, other regions of the globe, you know, in Japan and in Europe, you know, the rates actually turned negative. They went so low. They've recovered a little bit because Europe and Japan and the U.S. are riding in part the boom, mini boom here, of China's stimulus, which occurred last year. And the expectations as well of a Trump bump in the economy, Trump trade, meaning the financial markets boost, and Trump bump, meaning expectations of real investment. But that hasn't really materialized yet. And the Trump bump probably will turn, you know, into a little bump, if that. And the Trump trade is already fading here in the markets. Okay, but it's really, you know, the expectations Trump would do something, and the fact that China has done something that has given the economy a little six-month reprieve from what is essentially a low growth stagnation here since 2008. But the central bank has pumped all this money into the economy, bailed out the banks by 2010, and continued pumping all this free money into the economy with near zero rates until just recently. Why? Why has it done that? I mean, if the purpose of the central bank is to bail out the banks, which it did 6-7 years ago, why have these policies continued? Because the function of the central bank is to boost, to subsidize financial institutions, private institutions, corporations, and financial markets, to boost financial markets. You can see this very clearly because in places like Japan and Europe, the central banks actually go into the markets and buy stocks and buy private bonds. Well, that drives up the demand for the price of these stocks and bonds and increases the profits of investors that hold these stocks and bonds. The central bank, as part of the capitalist state, is now directly and structurally and consistently subsidizing finance capital and capital gains from financial investments. This is now built into the system. This wasn't the case before 2000, but it's become the characteristic in case of 20th century global capitalist economy. This direct subsidization, which is ongoing and permanent, it's part of the state propping up the system. And that's because the system can't and hasn't been generating as lucrative profits as can be obtained from this direct subsidy of financial asset markets. No longer just bailing out the banks, but direct subsidy of permanent subsidy of the financial system, subsidy in terms of profitability here. That's now the role of the central bank. We'll talk about what the functions of central banking have been and how they've evolved since the creation of central banks. You know, central banks are kind of a new phenomenon, new, modern, related to modern capitalist economy. They haven't always existed. We'll talk a little bit about the history. I have a chapter in my book, by the way, and all this is kind of a summary of my forthcoming book in a few weeks here. Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes is the title, subtitled Monetary Policy in the Next Depression. And what I want to talk about today is the problems and contradictions of central banking and a brief history of central banking, a kind of a background to central banking. Right? And in future weeks when we, in subsequent weeks here on the show, we'll go further. We'll talk about the origins of central banks and the failure to establish central bank in the U.S. in the 18th and 19th century. The first Bank of the U.S. Established in 1791 and why it failed, and also other banks, other attempts in the 19th century to create national central banking, why it failed, and the great financial crash of 1907 and how that led to establishing the U.S. Central Bank in 1913, now called the Federal Reserve Bank. Okay, and the book also goes on after that to look at the evolution of the U.S. Fed here during the 1920s and Depression and during the 1960s and 70s. Volcker's Bank, Paul Volcker's Bank, Greenspan's Bank, Bernanke's Bank, and now Yellen's Bank. It also looks at compares and contrasts the U.S. Fed's evolution and functions with the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, and Bank of Japan, of which I will have chapters on, and also the People's Bank of China, which is a little bit different. But what's going on in China? A lot of talk about this, all this excess debt going on in China. What's been the role of the People's Bank of China as a central bank in creating all the massive liquidity that's led to this really excessive debt, and how China is chasing its shadow banks in the attempt to get a control over all the debt and speculation. Right? That's what we're going to look at. We'll contrast Bernanke's bank here with Yellen's bank, Fed, how they're different and similar, and where it's all going. Right? Why are central bankers at the end of their ropes? What does that mean to say that? That means monetary policy, which is in the driver's seat since 2008, is failing, and failing along a number of fronts, including bailing out and subsidizing the financial system. We'll explain how that bailout in 2008 and the continued subsidizing of investors and bankers in the financial system is leading to the same conditions that produced the last financial crisis. Excess liquidity is from the central bank. It comes from the central bank primarily, not totally, but primarily, creates the debt. And the debt, of course, leads to financial overinvestment, financial asset bubbles. When the bubbles break, as they all do at some point, right, it leads to financial price collapse, stocks, bonds, real estate, properties, so forth. It leads to financial defaults. When you have banking and financial institutions and defaults, that leads to what's called a credit crash. In other words, credit provided by the banking system dries up. Non-banks can't get loans in order to continue their operations. They start laying people off. The real economy begins to contract. real investment and real consumption begins to decline. That leads to recessions, mass layoffs, more consumption decline, slower and retreating economy. And that feeds into more financial market instability and crash. So you get in a downward spiral here when these financial bubbles implode. That's exactly what happened in the Great Depression. You know, we had the stock market financial bubble implode, but then it led to banking crashes, four of them, in fact, in sequence, 1930, 31, 32, 33. And as the financial system kept ratcheting down and further contractions, of course, so did the real economy follow it. And the real economy following it feeds back and exacerbates the financial crashes. So you get in a nasty downward spiral. This is sometimes called the debt deflation process. Debt created by excess liquidity and financial bubbles starts contracting prices, starts prices to contract. So deflation is what is the mechanism that drives the joint financial real economic contraction. But debt, excess debt and bubbles led to that. But the question is, what led to the excess debt? You see, this debt deflation theory, which means excess debt leads to price deflation, is an approach that was first proposed by an economist in the 1930s, Irving Fisher, to try to explain why and how the Depression was occurring. You know, Keynes did not explain, John Maynard Keynes, in 1935, how the Depression occurred. Keynes was focusing on why it was there and how to get out of it. In other words, only the second half of the crash, you know, how do we recover, and then why we were there as of mid-1930s. But Fisher attempted to explain how the Great Depression originated in the 1920s and all the financial speculation and all the financial bubbles, particularly stock bubble, and how that crash precipitated the Great Depression. So that's where you get the term debt deflation process. How excess debt created the financial price collapse that led to the Depression itself. Right? There are a number of people who have been talking about debt since it's so obvious. The runaway excess debt, which is now accelerating once again since 2008-09. Right? Writers like Michael Hudson and Graeber and others talk about debt and debt deflation, but they don't explain, well, how did we get so much debt and why are we still getting so much debt, accelerating debt once again since 2009, you know, back on the same track. And they often don't distinguish between government debt, which is a product of the private debt, and the causes of private debt. And the same with consumer debt. That's a consequence of the private sector debt and the lack of real growth and therefore income growth, and people turn to forms of credit to maintain the standard of living. And what you get is a rising household debt. And government debt is really the consequence of subsidizing the private sector, private corporate sector, and bailing it out periodically. So private debt, household debt, and government debt is really a function of processes that occur on the private corporate side. And, you know, that relationship between those three forms of debt is often not discussed and understood very well. By the way, I talk about that in great detail. That's a center theme in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in a Global Economy, How to Understand the Origins of Debt and the Consequences of Debt. But the origins of debt are really, reside in this excess liquidity creation. Excess liquidity. You can't have debt without credit, and you can't have credit without liquidity. Liquidity being money, right? money supply and those securities that are close to money in terms of liquidity. You know, liquidity simply means that it can be converted to cash and sold. Right? Cash, of course, is liquid, as is coins. Currency is totally liquid, but there is a whole spectrum of other financial assets that are near liquid and others that are not liquid at all. So when we talk about liquidity, we're talking about creating money in near money forms. And that's the banks. That's the bank, the central banks, and the banks together create the money. So it's important to understand how the debt got built. What are the causes and mechanisms by which we have this massive debt run-up, right? And how private corporate debt transmits into government and household debt. And why is it we can have long periods of debt buildup and financial bubbles before we have a crisis? In other words, nothing is done, even though it's very clear, as it is today, that the debt is escalating once again, and we've got bubbles occurring once again. They haven't; some of them haven't busted, but they will. They always do. And why is it that this debt run-up can occur over a long period before it goes bust, right? And why do we have runaway liquidity creation as the source of debt? What's the role of the central banks in this liquidity creation and therefore in the debt creation? In other words, central banks create the debt problem. But then if liquidity is the cause, ultimately the fundamental originating cause of the debt buildup, excess liquidity by the central banks, why is it that the central banks tried to solve that problem with even more liquidity? In other words, when they bail out the banks, private banks, central banks, pump even more liquidity into those banks. Well, isn't that what caused the excess debt and the financial buildup in the bubbles in the first place? Yes, yes. So, you know, we have this great contradiction of liquidity creating debt and financial bubbles and crises, and liquidity as the solution proposed short-term to the crises, which just simply creates even subsequent crises of even greater dimensions. And that's what's going on. That's what's going on, right? With the central banks. This whole process of liquidity generation really began to accelerate in the 1970s. You see, when the Bretton Woods Agreement, International Monetary Agreement, collapsed in 73, it used to be that currencies were pegged to the dollar and the dollar to gold, but that was all thrown overboard in 1973, and the central banks were given the sole responsibility thereafter to maintain stability between the different currencies, currency exchange rates, in other words. Before, the currencies were pegged, you see. In a gold standard, it's a hard peg to gold. But, you know, with the post-war period, the gold standard collapsed in the 20s and 30s. And in the post-war period, what supplanted it was this quasi-gold standard established at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in 1944, in which the U.S. and its dollar became the global trading and reserve currency. And it was pegged to gold. But that was all upended. But once it was upended and the central banks were released, you know, the Kraken monster was released, the Kraken monster of liquidity, central banks were to manage that stabilization of the currencies thereafter, when there was no more gold-dollar standard, you see. And ever since then, central banks have just been pumping liquidity after liquidity into the economy, especially, you know, the major central banks. And the dollar, being the dominant currency in the world, the Federal Reserve, that was the key primary form of generating more liquidity into the global economy. Other major central banks played a role as well, but mostly the the U.S. Every time there was a financial problem, the Federal Reserve intervened and bailed out, the financial systems and the markets. This began to appear in the 70s and grow even further in the 1980s. The bailouts were limited, though, to certain markets, like savings and loans and junk bonds and so forth. And they weren't system-wide. They weren't global-wide yet. They began to go global-wide in the 1980s when the U.S. eliminated all controls on money capital flows and all the other countries followed. That's when we get globalization and global financialization beginning in the 1980s. And then after that, we see these financial bubbles getting worse and more severe, not just in single markets and single financial institutions, but across markets and institutions. And then they went global. Japan in 1991 had its big crash, right? Northern European, Scandinavian banks had a problem at the same time. Emerging markets started to have a problem. We get the Asian crisis in 1997-98, Asian meltdown, as it was called. China had financial problems in the 90s. And then we get the dot-com bust due to overinvestment in financial stocks and tech. And in the meantime, the global housing crisis and derivatives expansion based upon this speculation begins to occur with a vengeance in the late 90s, early 2000s, and we get the big crash in 2008. And the same processes that led to that are continuing, you see. Where will the next bubble be? Well, the U.S. stocks are clearly in a bubble. We don't know if that's going to be the central focus. China has big problems with its shadow banks and financial markets. We saw their stock market boom and bust, and now we got bubbles reappearing over there in housing speculation and local government finance and state enterprises, entrusted loans, wealth management products, and so forth. I have an extensive chapter on that, of course, in the new book called The People's Bank of China Chases Its Shadows, a long chapter looking at the financial instability, debt growing, and the origins of it in the People's Bank of China and a few other sources of generating excess liquidity. You see, liquidity is the key. It's not debt. Debt is a consequence of the excess liquidity. So you have to identify where's the liquidity coming from. Well, it's coming mostly from central banks, but of course you can have credit creation without central banks as well. That's a problem, and it's growing too. But it's the liquidity that's the issue, not just the debt. And the central banks are the source of this massive, massive liquidity, trillions and tens of trillions of dollars of liquidity injections that are designed to, bail out the banks and financial institutions whenever they periodically get in trouble, and they do. And now the troubles are getting more widespread. They're becoming global, and they're deeper, and they're across markets. So the whole process is continuing to deepen and grow. We have this anomaly of the central banks bailing out the banks and continuing the gusher of free money ever since 2010. And what have they done in the U.S. with all this free money, the banks and non-banks? A lot of it's been invested in financial markets rather than in real investment. And to the extent it's been real investment, it's gone offshore. That's been, encouraged by free trade and the tax policy of the U.S. Send that money offshore. And, of course, we know the consequences of all that. What we see in the 21st century is the capitalist state is taking an ever deeper role in subsidizing capital itself. This is not free markets. We're nowhere near free markets. In fact, it's increasingly unfree as the state steps in to subsidize. How does the state subsidize capital? Well, we see it through tax cuts. More and more and more tax cuts for business ever since Reagan. Business tax cuts, investor tax cuts. We see it in austerity fiscal policy. In other words, if you're going to cut taxes, you're going to exacerbate your deficit and your debt, government. So we got to cut fiscal spending in order to offset the loss of revenue from taxation. Right? Austerity fiscal policy follows the tax cut policy, and the tax cut policy is designed to subsidize businesses, just like the central bank subsidizes businesses. How does it subsidize them? Well, in a number of ways. One, zero interest rates. By massively increasing liquidity, it drives down interest rates and, in effect, provides free money to banks. Banks take that near zero cost of money, and they turn it around and they loan it to other financial institutions, shadow banks, to other banks, and to other non-financial corporations, multinational corporations expanding abroad and so forth, right? And it's that spread between what they get free money from the Fed and what they loan it out to other sources that constitutes a big part of their profits, banks' profits. But that's not the only way the banks make profits, of course. Banks will take that free money and not simply loan it to somebody else, but invest it themselves directly in financial markets and then invest it directly in other places and other forms, in stocks and bonds and derivatives and stock trading and foreign exchange trading and properties, commodities, and so forth, right? So it's not just loaning out money to others that the banks make through the spread, their super profits. It's also direct investment themselves, right? So direct purchases of stocks and bonds. Right? Now, to keep the stock and bond prices rising, ever rising, the central banks are now playing in that game, too. It used to be they would just buy and sell government bonds with their affiliated banks, but they don't do that anymore. Now they go directly into the market, and they direct purchase stocks and bonds themselves, the central banks. Japan, massive purchases of stocks on the private stock exchanges and private corporate bonds. Well, that drives up the price of stocks and bonds, and that means more profits for investors who also invest in stock and bond markets. And the same goes for derivatives and foreign exchange markets, right? So the central bank is playing an increasing role, unlike ever before, in pushing up the price of these stocks and bonds and other derivatives markets by directly purchasing itself. The central banks are acting like private banks, investing in private financial securities. And at the same time, they're providing all this free money to banks who do the same, who invest in private stocks and bonds and financial securities. Or the banks loan to other investors who invest in stocks and bonds and private financial securities. So all this demand, fed by all this excess liquidity, drives up the price of all and the values, the capital gains for investors, bankers and non-bankers and private and shadow and so forth, from all these financial booms and price increases in financial asset markets. This is what's going on, a big subsidy of financial markets going on. And ultimately, at the root of it lies the central banks. That's their primary function now. Textbook theory says, what are the functions of central banking? Well, first, regulate the money supply. Well, we don't see any regulation of money supply. What we see is a runaway boosting of the money supply going on since the 1970s and 80s. Well, okay, so it has something, central bank functionality has something to do with trying to regulate the money supply, even though I wouldn't call it regulation. I would call it, you know, runaway stimulation here. But, you know, that's one of the functions. Another function historically, in fact, this is how central banks originated, is to gather private funds for the government, you know, to raise funds for the government for their wars and their big projects from time to time that they do that private sector won't do, like, you know, national highway systems and so forth, right? Central banks begin, you know, the history of central banks began in 1694 with the Bank of England, the first central bank created. But, you know, that as a central bank, you know, just the rudimentary functions of raising money for the government. It was really a private bank. See, these central banks have always had this private bank characteristic to them. And in 1694, you know, the first function of raising money, this is where central banks really begin, raising money for the government. They're private banks that then take on the function of raising money for the government. And then we see, but there are no other central banks then. We see other central banks beginning to originate around 1800. You know, once again, you know, Bank of France, Napoleon, needed money to conduct his wars, so he creates the Bank of France, and the other European countries create their national central banks at the time. And then over time, a second function is assumed by the central banks, you know, in the mid-19th century, and that is monopoly over the creation of currency, of the money. Money existed before then, but, you know, private sources of creation of money were the rule. And it wasn't until the mid-19th century that the central banks tried to bring some order to a currency creation. So creating the currency, you know, printing the currency and the coins, that becomes a function of central banking as well as this other function, original, of raising money for governments, right? When you have the creation of money monopolized by the Bank of England in 1844 and in the U.S. Later in other countries, what you get is the ability to control the money supply. You see, when all these private banks are creating their own money, which was a problem in the U.S. throughout the 19th century, then you have no way of controlling the money supply. So the capitalist state creates central banks in part also to try to influence and bring order to this chaos of private currency creation. Yeah. But the real function of central banks, especially in the 20th century, is to bail out the private banks. And they periodically always get into trouble. Central banks are supposed to engage in bank supervision, another function, but that's just a facade. They never really truly supervise the private banking system. They go through the motions of that. And as a result of that, the private banking systems periodically, regularly get into crashes and crises, and the central bank has to bail them out. You see, central banks are created as political cover for the rest of the government. The governments do not bail out the banks. To do so would be, you know, a real political risk. To do so looks like, well, we got a crash and great depression, economic problem, and here's the government, our elected representatives, bailing out these banks, but not us. Well, they create a central bank to do that. And whenever there's a bailout, the central bank just prints the money, you see, to bail out the private banks. And that gives cover for elected politicians. They can point the finger and blame the central bank. And people generally don't understand very well how the central banks work and how they do a bailout. We can see this very clearly what happened in 2008. You know, very stupidly, the Bush Treasury attempted to bail out the banks. It was called TARP. The TARP program, Troubled Asset Relief Program, where then Secretary of the Treasury Paulson went and asked Congress for $750 billion to bail them, to bail out the bank. So that was a big mistake. You see, it looked like the government, elected representatives, were bailing out the banks, and they didn't want to be tagged with that. And initially, they said no to Paulson, but then they got scared and approved, gave him a blank check. $750 billion, which, by the way, only a couple hundred billion, 300 billion was ever spent, and the rest was sent back to the Treasury, and it was spent not on bailing out the banks so much, except for AIG. It was spent on bailing out the auto companies. And again, under Obama, the money was put back, and the real bailout of the banks occurred by the Federal Reserve in 2009, you see, when the Federal Reserve dropped interest rates to 0.1% for the banks, called zero interest rate program, ZIRP, and then pumped nearly $5 trillion in direct liquidity through quantitative easing, you see, and other special auctions for different sectors of the banking system. You see, the Federal Reserve bailed out the banks. And that's always the primary function, to bail out the banks, go through the motions of supervision, help raise money for the government, perform a function called fiscal agent, in other words, where the central bank, the Fed, actually pays the bills of the Treasury and of the government. You know, it takes in money and pays the money. It's the fiscal agent, you know. And other functions like clearinghouse function, central bank reconciles the payments between the banks every day electronically now, so that there is a central source and expedites the payments between the banks owing each other and so forth. You know, these are secondary functions. Printing money, that's a secondary, and coins, that's a secondary function. Doing research, that's a secondary function on the economy. The Fed and central banks do all of this. The primary function, raising money for the government, bailing out the banks, that's the primary function in the 20th century of these banks. Secondary function, controlling the money supply, you know, making it look like there's bank supervision, etc. I mean, if there were effective bank supervision, we wouldn't have crashes, right? We wouldn't have to do lender of last resort function. It's called bailing out the banks, lender of last resort, the same function. Right? You know, providing all this liquidity, and then after 1970s and 80s, over-providing liquidity and just keep the flow going, leads us to the 20th century, where now the real function is subsidizing the private financial system, making sure it's not only profitable, but its profitability rises. And you do that by boosting financial asset markets, as well as providing free money to the banks. So it's not only bailing out the banks, lender of last resort, that's key. That's 20th century, and that's continuing, of course, as a primary function. But the other function is subsidize the system, keep the profitability going. That's why free money for 6 years after the banks were effectively bailed out. You see, the banks were, the function of lender of last resort occurred in 2008-09. After that, it was not necessary. The function of subsidizing, the state subsidizing the banks, and the financial system continued after that. In the 21st century, right, it's about financialization. What is financialization? Well, you know, those on the left, I think, are confused a little bit about what financialization is. Sometimes they call it the growing influence of the FIRE sector, F-I-R-E, you know, finance, insurance, real estate. Well, that's far too narrow a definition. And, you know, the indication of financialization as FIRE is these sectors of the financial economy growing in profitability, taking a greater share of profits, hiring more employees, and so forth. That's not what financialization is. Financialization is global, and it's a changing structure. It's the rise of shadow banks, unregulated, high-risk banking investment, right? Shadow bank institutions growing up alongside the commercial banks, Chase, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, commercial banks, right? And the blending of shadow bank type activities and financing, where there's a high risk, no reserves, you know, no cushion, invest it all, fractional banking without the fraction. Shadow banks have more assets, investable assets today than commercial banks, and they're outside the regulatory framework. In other words, there's not much regulation of them globally in particular. And we get blended, commercial banks, shadow banks. Commercial banks acting like shadow banks, creating off-balance sheet activities and so forth. Even non-bank financial or non-financial companies, like multinational companies, these are financial companies as well. You know, one quarter to one-third of all their profits are generated from financial investments in stocks, bonds, derivatives, and so forth. So they act like banks, in part. It's this changing global structure that's becoming more financialized, greater weight of shadow banking and hybrid versions and so forth, and shadow banking activities. Now that's part of the global restructuring here, financial restructuring. That's really been occurring since the 1980s. Along with these institutions, of course, is the creation of all these highly liquid financial asset markets globally, and creation of securities, financial securities of various kinds, sometimes called financial engineering, in which to sell, buy and sell by these shadow banks in these liquid markets. Of course, shadow banks are not just institutions, they're people. You know, who's behind the shadow banks? Who owns the shadow banks? Who invests through the shadow banking system, right, in these liquid markets, in these new financial asset securities? Right? Well, it's a new finance capital elite that has arisen in the last several decades, about 200,000 of them of very high net worth individuals who do nothing except move their money around this global structure of financial asset markets. So all this excess liquidity has fed the growth of these institutions and these agencies, these individuals, and their institutional framework and their markets and all their securities that they're buying and selling. It's become a financial casino, you see, and it's far more profitable than real investment in real things. So investment, money, capital keeps getting sucked out of the real sector of the economy into this financial structure. And that, of course, leads to the slowdown in real investment and productivity and so forth that we talked about. Now, this finance capital elite is not only solidifying and deepening its control and influence over the global economy, it's doing the same over the political structures and political systems. The finance capital elite is capturing the broad government. It's not just regulatory agencies anymore. They've essentially captured broad sectors of the presidential cabinet. You know, the U.S. Treasury Secretary since the 90s has always been a big banker for Citigroup and now Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs is running the whole economy here through the Trump administration. You know, Trump is what? It's an administration of generals in Goldman Sachs. That's what it is. Central banks, of course, are part of this. In my book, I show how this private banking system has deepened its influence over central banks' policy and strategy. Yes, it's very important. Central banks are part of the government structure, but they've been captured as well, just as the Treasury has been captured. Increasingly, just as the key committees in the Congress have been captured by the finance capital elite, and of course regulatory agencies like the SEC and the Comptroller of the Currency and so forth, right? And this has occurred in the last 20-25 years. There's a parallel growing political control of the finance capital elite over the political system, just as there's a growing deepening influence and control over the real economy by this new new element here. And you know, again, we go back to how it was all enabled. It's all enabled by the liquidity created by the central banks and by the credit system and technology, which, in other words, it's not just central banks that are creating credit anymore and creating credit through creating money, but you can create credit technologically here, bypassing the central bank. That's a new technology development underway as well. Right? So anyway, you know, it's liquidity, it's the central bank now subsidizing the state apparatus. I mean, the capitalist economy, this is its primary function in the 21st century. So we really need to understand how central banks function economically and politically here. And that's what the topic of my book, Central Themes, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, is all about. Okay, next week we're going to talk about how central banking originated in the United States.